the NBC Sports Grill and Brew at Universal Orlando Resort. Here's David Faraday.
Hello. How are you all doing? Thank you so much for not being somewhere else. Tonight's show features a guest who's been proclaimed the sexiest man alive and one of the 100 most influential people in the world. Quite an accomplishment for someone with a brother named Rooster. And no, I'm not talking about Frank. Okay? Although it would have been accurate. No, I'm actually referring to Matthew McConaughey. Matthew's a true American original. He and I first met while standing on a rooftop in Rio de Janeiro. After about 10 minutes of talking to him, I just knew I had to have him on the show. He's equal parts Hollywood superstar, metaphysical philosopher, and four handicapper. And his first job was raking bunkers at a golf course in Longview, Texas. And his big break came not from an audition, but rather a golf discussion that became so animated, it got him kicked out of a bar. I met up with Matthew at Spanish Oaks in Austin, Texas.
So, first time out in 8 months?
Boy, it's not bad at all.
Sit.
I don't think I'd change much about your game, you know?
You gonna hit some balls, or are you just gonna critique me? Oh, you stay up dry.
How far heavy can you go?
Unbelievable amount of confidence, I have to say, for someone who plays golf once a year.
What are you saying, I'm talking the right game? I sound like I know what I'm talking
about? No, but you're just comfortable in your own skin.
That's it.
Look at that shot.
I'm kind of happy with that swing.
I would be.
You're pretty comfortable in your skin, too.
Well, but there's so much of it. I mean, it's hard not to get comfortable in here. How do you go from, I think I'll be an attorney, to dazed and confused?
I was in the right bar at the right time.
I know that feeling.
You know?
Yeah.
And I met a guy who was in town producing the film Dazed and Confused.
Cut to 4 hours later, we get kicked out of So Said Bar because we're replaying the 17th hole at this TPC course we had both played, and we were evidently too animated playing it. We kicked out, and on the ride home, he's like, hey, you ever done any acting? And I was like, man, I was in a Miller Lite commercial for about that long. And he goes, well, you might be right for this part. Come on down to this address, pick up this thing. He's an older guy named Wooderson. He's still hanging around high school, likes the high school girls and stuff. Come on down and check it out. Be at this address. I go down 9:30 the next morning, which was really only about 4 hours later. There's the script waiting for me. One of the scenes was this guy, Wooderson's hanging out in front of the pool hall. Girl goes walking by, he kind of slaps her backside, and his buddy says, man, you gotta cut that out, Wooderson. You're gonna end up in jail. And Wooderson says, no, man, that's what I like about those high school girls. I get older, but they stay the same age. And I'm like, who is that guy? And I always called, it's what I would term a launch pad line. That line launched my imagination into who this guy Wooderson would be. And I remember this, I go to read for it, my first job interview. And what I do, I'm a frat boy, Delta Tau Delta fraternity here at Texas. I shave, tuck in, iron my jeans to go in for my job interview. And then the director's like, you're not this guy. I go, no, but I know who this guy is. And he goes, okay, you wanna do it? And I kind of went, kicked back in the chair and did the whole deal. And he was like, okay, you got the part. Now, I get called to set one night, and they do what's called a makeup and wardrobe test. Well, I step out on the curb that night, and Richard Linklater, the director, is like, oh, this is great. This is Wooderson. Goes, you know, man, he goes, you know, we're here at the Top Notch tonight, to drive-through burger joint. And you know, Wooderson's probably been with all the kind of typical hot ladies in high school, you know, the cheerleaders and stuff. I'm like, right. And he goes, you think you'd be interested in, like, the redheaded intellectual? And I'm like, oh, yeah, man, Wooderson likes all kinds, man. He's like, well, you know, she's sitting here in a car with her friends. Maybe you, like, pull up and, you know, try to pick her up. I'm like, all right. He goes, want to shoot it? I'm like, okay. So, boom, I'm
and
in the
this
car.
Is your first scene?
First scene, and it's not written. That's all we know is I'm going to go pick up. So I'm getting the car. And I'm getting a little anxious, like, okay, what's going on? Who's my man? Who's Wooderson? What's Wooderson about? And I'm like, okay, let's be real simple here. Wooderson's about my car. And I'm like, well, I'm in my 70 Chevelle. There's one. I said, Wooderson's about rock and roll. I said, there we go. We got Ted Nugent Stranglehold in the 8-track. There's two. I said, Wooderson's about getting high. I'm like, well, Slater, the greatest stoner, sitting riding shotgun, you know he's got a doobie rolled up. And I look up and I go, look across the way off screen, and there she sits, the redhead. And I go, and Wooderson's about chicks. I got three out of four. Let's go get the fourth.
all right, and pulled out. And those are my three mental affirmations of, I've got three, let's go get the fourth. And that's the first lines I ever said on screen. And it's kind of a reason why I still say it to kick off, you know, things, because it gets me in a good mood and makes me laugh. And that's what that was, first words I ever said.
I want to go back to one of your earlier roles, Unsolved Mysteries. Do you remember the name of the character you played?
Larry Dickens.
Yeah.
Somebody saw that Unsolved Mysteries, tuned him in today. I knew who that guy was who came and did those lewd things and killed that guy. They caught the guy 2 weeks later.
That's got to be a pretty cool feeling.
That was cool. And so my brothers still give me heck about that because I would always joke. It was so good that people saw it and they caught the bad guy, man. So my brother's always like, oh, yeah, so now you think you're just like, okay, you're a lifesaver, man. You're not a lifeguard, you're a lifesaver. You went out, you portrayed one guy and they caught the bad guy. But they did, they caught him in 2 weeks.
Was there ever a time that you felt like, you know, maybe you're getting typecast or?
Sure.
Yeah.
I was doing romantic comedies. I was enjoying doing romantic comedies. Romantic comedies were paying well. I was like the top rom-com guy. Mm. And I was enjoying them, but it was all I was kind of getting submitted. It was the only scripts I was getting submitted. And so I didn't have anything to do, but I did say I'm going to consciously stop and not do what I've been getting offered. Well, word kind of got out in Hollywood that I wasn't going to do those other romantic comedies or the comedies that were coming my way. What I think happened is I did not rebrand in that 8 months. I unbranded in that 8 months. So whatever I was typecast as, all of a sudden, where's McConaughey? So I wasn't around. And I think I became some people's, hey, you know what the new good idea is? What about McConaughey for this drama or something? And then I started getting offered some really interesting roles and started doing some things. And a lot of them turned out to be dramas, and I've enjoyed it.
What about Ron Woodruff? Dallas Buyers Club. I mean, he was the hero, but he was really sort of awful.
That script was not about a guy who waved the white flag and said, come on, I'm the revolutionary here. He was a selfish bastard businessman trying to stay alive. That's the ultimate obstacle to have. Now, how do you overcome that? So my choice in that was to play the businessman, play the selfish SOB, and the humanity will hopefully revere itself. Again, it's that word. They use the word sympathy a lot, which I'm not as much of a fan of with characters. Empathy, yes. Mm. Empathy is just if I can understand you, if I understand that guy, if I understand Ron Woodruff, oh, I hear where he's coming from, then I feel like we got a great character or someone we can understand.
How did you prepare for that role?
Well, first I went and met his family. They were so open to me coming in to their home and talking to me about who he was. Mm-hmm. And they did an interesting thing. After I spent a day with him, they gave me his diary. And that was my secret weapon, because all of a sudden, then I found a guy in his diary who, on Sunday night, was pressing his slacks, making sure he had a fresh battery in his pager, write out meticulously what he's going to do. Monday morning, I'm going across town, 8 a.m., going to install these stereo speakers for this couple. Going to make $80, you know, and then going to come back at 11. I got to call back so-and-so about rewiring their house alarm or smoke alarm or something. And through the week, you'd see him, I'm going to get a job Tuesday, Wednesday, and then come about Thursday. You could tell he got a little apathetic with, man, my week's not working. I'm not making the money. I didn't get the jobs I wanted. Come Friday, he's drinking a little bit earlier, kind of starting to party a little bit. And so he'd slip into that, and then he'd get fired back up on Sunday night to go have my work week. And it never panned out.
You win the Oscar for it. Was it affirmation for you?
Well, that's the gold standard in our industry for saying par excellence.
Yeah.
It was affirmation on the fact that this is my peers saying, we deem the work you did to be excellent. Yeah. We deem it to be really great work.
The one that really put you on the map, was it A Time to Kill?
Yeah.
How did that change you?
That was a Friday before that opened, and I'm walking down 3rd Street Promenade, Santa Monica, California. 400 people. 396 are doing their own thing. 4 people are looking at me. Maybe a couple girls who think I'm cute. Maybe it's somebody else who's just like, hey, I've seen that guy somewhere. Cut to Monday after the weekend. I walked down the same promenade. It inverted. 396 looking at me. And 4 not. So from that Friday, when I had 100 scripts I would say yes to, but 99 of them were no, that Monday, those 100 scripts, 99 were yeses.
Yeah.
And one no. So it was thrilling. It was a ride. I loved it. I remember going to the grocery store and looking down and seeing myself on two covers of magazines. I was like, I'm buying a couple of those. And I remember telling the clerk, going, look at that guy. Now, the thing that happens is there's a certain anonymity, I think, that any artist needs. All of a sudden, yeah. I don't meet any strangers anymore.
Yeah. And that's
even
a difficult thing.
Met you. You have a bio on me.
Yeah.
So instead of saying, hey, what's your name? David, you're already going, I'm so sorry about Miss Hud. Did she get over that cancer? And you're going, wait a minute. One, how'd you know I had a dog? Two, how'd you know she had cancer? Three, how'd you know that she's in her last month? Whatever it would be.
People magazine?
You'd cut into a very, people would naturally come right into it. No, I already know about you. And you skip the salutation of, hi, how you doing?
Yeah.
And, you know, it's nice to meet people that you never even asked the question, so what do?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And so for me, I had to go seek places where I could earn my merit through anonymity. So I found places. I take some walkabouts, South America, West Africa, and I take off by myself with a backpack and go for 23 days to a place where nobody knew my name. Nobody knew I was John Doe. No one knew what I did. And my merit in those places were only measured by the man they met when I got there and the man I was when I left.
Right.
And I needed that.
Well, normally when actors talk about their trailer, it's like something on set, you know, you go into it, whatever. But you actually moved into an Airstream trailer at one point.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I lived on the road. It was just, I was single. I was living with my dog, Miss Hud. And, you know, had a little technology just come out. You had your Blackberries and stuff. And all of a sudden I was like, I think I can do this. I think I can be on the road and still stay incommunicado with my industry.
Yeah.
I don't have to live in L.A. Let's go live and open up the calendar and say, I'm in Missouri. Where's Clemens pitch next Tuesday? Let's go to St. Louis or let's go to, Florida and go watch him pitch.
Towing an Airstream?
Yeah.
By yourself? Well,
yeah,
with
my dog. Yeah. Or, hey, where's the Cult playing, you know, next Wednesday? Oh, really? They're in Jersey. Well, that would take about 5 days. Let's go see the Cult. So I was just traversing around the country, and I would take meetings. Like, if we were going to do this interview or director meetings, I'd say, okay, you want to meet tomorrow? I'm in El Paso. I'm headed northwest. Tell you what, why don't I pick you up in Albuquerque tomorrow at 4 p.m.? Hang with me the night. We'll go do the interview where I'm going to camp out. And then the next morning, I'm going to cut back, and I'll drop you off in Flagstaff. So get an exit flight at Flagstaff at 9 a.m., but come into Albuquerque. So I would pick someone up on the road. We'd have a meeting, which the best place to have a meeting with somebody or conversations, driving down the road or camping out. And then I'd drop them off at another airport.
Was there anybody that you bumped into during that period that you wouldn't have, you know, had you led the other life?
Oh, there's quite a few. We could do 5 hours on just my travel stories, the characters I ran into. I ran into Bill and Eileen, they call themselves lifers. They put 2 million miles in the RV life now.
Whoa.
Work to retire, and their only regret is they didn't do this 40 years earlier.
Do they know who you are at this point? You know, I mean, they just bumped into Matthew McConaughey.
No, most of them wouldn't.
Right.
Sometimes I'd run into people, but most of these people are not people. They're living on the road, so they're not people that are actually going to the theater, and actually a lot of them don't even have televisions. So their life has been on the road, and so you're meeting kind of people that are just like that transient lifestyle, gypsy from popping in place to place. I had this one guy. I'm like outside of Biloxi, Mississippi, I think, and I wake up early in the morning, and I notice there's a casino right across the street, and out of the door, I see this little guy about 120, dressed up. He had ruffled, but you could tell that he went out with his dappers on, all dressed up, but he's coming out, and it was daylight, and the sun blinds him, and you could tell he didn't know it was that late. And he walks up, and as he gets close enough, I notice his eyes are looking above my head. And I'm like, morning. And he goes, without looking at me in the eye, he's still just staring at me. He goes, what in the hell is that blue light up there? And I go, and I see it's my satellites up, the blue lights up. I go, oh, that's a blue light on my satellite. He goes, I know that, but what the hell is it? And I go, it's a blue light that means my satellite's locked in and I can watch direct. I know that, but what the hell is it? And I go, it's a blue LED light. that just shines when we're on. And he goes, first time, lowers his eyes, looks at me, and goes like, I gotta get me one of them.
And walks off.
Okay, rapid fire with Matthew McConaughey. Everybody knows the rules, like stupid answers to even stupider questions. Start an imaginary clock, okay? Now, if you need an attorney, which of your on-screen lawyers would you hire?
If you don't have much money, better get Mickey Haller. He'll take your car, repossess your house or something, no problem.
Hollywood is?
Hollywood is America's greatest export.
What's your favorite quote from Raising Arizona?
Well, my wife, she's a tiger, as in T-I-G-E-R.
Give me a percentage of how often your name is spelled correctly.
More and more now.
Yeah.
More and more now.
Well, it's said that you dance to the beat of a different drum, pun intended. What music best describes you?
I'll take the Ray Charles line on that. There's two kinds of music, good music and bad music, and I like good music.
What role do you wish you'd played?
L.A. Confidential.
All right.
That was an excellent movie that I was like, ooh, that would have been a good one to be in.
If you weren't an actor, you'd be
broke. Couldn't be. No, I don't think I'd be broke.
No.
I'd find a way to make some money somewhere.
I would be broke if I wasn't
I would either be I was going to be a lawyer, but then I think I would have, I still have a conducting future in me.
Did you really touch the tiger in Gold, or was that computer generated?
I really touched that tiger.
You did?
And you know what? It's no accident that they scheduled that scene to be the last scene we shot in the entire movie.
In case you got eaten.
Matthew, I brought along two magazines here. You're on the front of this one as the sexiest man alive. Mm-hmm. And this is not you, it's Robert Redford.
Yeah.
But you're in this one as one of the world's 100 most influential people. So which one is the real you?
What page am I on in that Time magazine one?
In the Time magazine, you are on...
There I am.
Right there.
Okay.
You know, much shorter hair.
Oh, yeah. Young bloke there.
Yeah.
That kid.
Yeah.
Well, you know, man, that did say sexiest man alive.
Alive?
So, like, I'm still alive.
Yes.
So I figure you can't lose that crown once you get it once.
Yeah.
There's multiple, obviously, sexiest men alive. I was influential for 1 year. I've still got time to be influential another year, but the gift that keeps giving is that old sexiest man.
Well, before you were the sexiest man alive, your high school voted you as the most handsome. Explain to me, though, how that cost your family $30,000.
My dad's still pissed in heaven about this. So 2 years prior to that, I'm, 15, 16, I get some pimples on my face like any pubescent adolescent kid gets,
yeah.
Right? Well, my mom was selling this stuff, sort of going door to door, oil of mink, right? And she's putting it on her face, and middle-aged women are putting it on their face. It's an oil-based thing. And she comes, well, I've got this stuff. And it's supposed to bring out all your impurities on your face. So, and I was like, well, will it help with these pimples? She's like, sure. So I start putting these oil mink masks on at night, right? Well, I start really breaking out. Anyway, it gets bad. I go to the dermatologist. He goes, oh, no. A 15-year-old kid shouldn't use an oil-based product. It's clogging up your pores. You got to get off this. I get on these pills, take Accutane. And somebody had the idea of, like, well, you know what? There should be a lawsuit against this company. We go on now as depositions take. A couple years later, we're in the senior year. I've lost the acne, right?
Bummer.
Face is cleared up. The guy for the prosecution is like, so it was so mentally tough for you? And I'm like, yes, sir. And he goes, tell me about how hard it was. I was like, oh, man, I wasn't doing near as good with the girls and the ladies. I mean, my golf game got better because I was just feeling really isolated, but I had psoriasis in my knees and joint. He was like, it must have been just so, so tough. And I went, yes, sir. And he reaches under the table and pulls out the yearbook. He goes, what's this page right here? What's this award you won? And I read it, and I go, most handsome. And I knew at 8:17 right then, I was like, we just lost the case. And right then, and my dad was like, you son of a bitch, had to go and win most handsome. We could have made $35,000 off of that, but you got to go win most handsome.
Well, what would he think of you now?
I think he'd love it. He was a ham.
Yeah?
My whole family's hams. Well, Pat's not, but Rooster and my mom and my dad were hams, and he loved stories, and so much of the stuff that I get now are inspirations from either who he was or who I thought he was, because there's always a romanticized impression that you have of your father or your parents, you know, and what you may believe from the impression of who you thought they were when you were 15 or 16 sometimes can serve to be more truth than if you found out the real truth.
Yeah.
He would have loved it. What I He would have loved reading the scripts. He would have loved saying, hey, what about if you tried this? Or, hey, do you know this? I know this guy who actually has a lot in him that's like this character you're playing. He would have loved talking about it. Because my dad was much more of a creative man than I knew, and I found out he was more creative actually after he had passed away. We found old paintings, really good stuff that he had painted, sculptures. And I didn't know that after I was going to bed at night, he was going in the garage and doing sculptures and painting and stuff. And so he really liked artistic things and creative expressions. I called him when I was going to go to law school. He was the phone call. It was kind of like that I don't want to play football talk. Mm-hmm. And I was very nervous about saying I don't want to go to law school. I want to go to film school. And he, again, waited 5 seconds after I said, I want to go to film school. And I'm on the other end of the line thinking, oh, geez. Waited 5 seconds, and he goes, is that what you want to do? I went, yes, sir. And he goes, don't half-ass it. Mm-hmm. And that was it. And then I was off, and I exhaled. And I was like, oh, I've got the support of my dad. And he would have loved it. He would have loved being out there with my friends. He would have loved premieres, but I think he would also love coming to the set and seeing how many awesome creative people I get to work with and these storytellers, and he'd have put in his 2 cents everywhere. It would have been super fun.
Yeah. You were pretty friendly with Payne, weren't you?
Yeah, I got to know Payne. We met in a Vegas tournament and got to play together, and he was always my favorite golfer before then. Then we got to play together, and then he invited me down to his house with his family. I stayed with him there in Orlando, played a couple rounds with him and Stuart Appleby.
Yeah.
And then stayed in contact with him. I remember about Payne, of all his championships, the Ryder Cup was the one that really, he really got off to.
Yeah, it really did it for Payne. Yeah.
That was the mantle shot of his golf history for him. And I dug that about him.
I played him in the 91 Ryder Cup in the singles, and I was four up with four to play, probably the best round of golf I ever played. And I lost two holes in a row, 15 and 16. And I was trying to get to the 17th tee. The crowd had broken down. You know, all the marshals were all over the place. And, you know, there was, ole, 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 shut up. I hate the word to that song. And Lady Marshall got in front of me and poked me with her quiet police sign. She said, where do you think you're going? And like, I'm a heavily disguised spectator.
Right.
And I was about to go bat crazy. And,
two up, two to go.
But, yeah, but I think I'm going to lose 17. I've just lost 15 and 16. You know, I'm in bad shape. But this arm comes around my shoulder, and Payne put his face right on mine, and I can still smell the red man from the plug that he had in. And he said, ma'am, I'd love you to keep this asshole here, but he's playing against me, and he swept me up onto the tee. But you're right, that's who he was.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, he loved the Ryder Cup, but he was a great sportsman. Even though he gave people a hard time.
Right.
He loved to, you know, poke the needle in.
Take just the piss out,
Yeah. He loved it. How important were sports to you growing up?
We played everything. I played my 12 years of soccer. Played 12 years of baseball. You know, playing in school turned into let's go play for the Methodist Church where my brother was the coach. It wasn't until I found golf, though, that I was like, oh, this is what I think I can be. This is what I love to do, and this is as a sport, not a necessary profession, but this is the game that I feel like I understand the most and I can be better at. So I got to a four handicap. That's when I was like, okay, I've got something. I knew it was the first sport I was in where I really knew and looked forward to going to the range after school and working on it to get a little bit better, or when something went wrong, to be able to define what it was. And that was the sport I understood the most. I mean, growing up in Texas, you know, football's king. But I remember the conversation I had with my dad coming out of the eighth grade. And I had said, and I was real nervous about telling him I didn't want to play football anymore. Because my dad played pro ball for Green Bay in 53, and he played under Larry Bryant at Kentucky and then University of Houston. And I remember being very nervous about the night, calling him back to say, Dad, I don't think I want to play football. I maybe want to play golf. And as soon as I told him, he was like, oh, that's great news. And I was like, well, why? And he goes, you know, you can hear it's me coming to your room before I get there. And I go, yes, sir. And he goes, what do you hear? And I said, I hear this.
Oh, from football?
Yeah. He goes, that's a metal plate in my ankle. That's a hyperextended knee from a punt return where I saw the bottom of my cleat. That's a 4x2-inch steel plate in my lower back. He goes, man, play golf. You can do that till you go down. So he was happy, actually, that I didn't choose football.
Are there similarities in the crafts, you know, acting and golf, or for that matter, you know, being at the top of any, you know, sport?
Every time I have a scene, I have a need. clear need in that scene, but I also have to have an obstacle. Because if I only have a need with no obstacle, I just steamroll over things and it's a flat performance. So I have to give my obstacles credit and figure out a way to overcome them in each scene. That's sort of how I break down my scripts and story. I think you can look at golf the same way. I also like what Jack Nicklaus has said about, can you think about golf the entire 18 holes? And he said, no, there's no way.
Yeah.
I have to I hit a shot, I take a break, I walk around, I take in the course, maybe I chat a little bit, but 35 yards out on the walk and the approach to my shot is when I start getting into what's the next shot, what's the lie look like, what's the distance, what's gonna be my play here, where's trouble, all the way through taking the shot and then release again. I have to do that when I'm working. I prepare for my 3 months going up. So that's when my hard work is, preparation. Mm-hmm. When I go to work on day one, when I do it well, I'm playing now. Now I'm playing the course.
Right.
Now I'm playing around. Now I'm being young. Now I'm trying things out. Who cares? That's when I got the freedom. Tension is an actor's worst enemy. Tension is a golfer's worst enemy.
Yeah.
So there's a relaxation within the structure, too, because I've gone the other way. You can get too loose, go off the rails, you know, and decide not to lay up and hop in the creek and take your shoes off and Vondeville the thing. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Now, you did Failure to Launch with Terry Bradshaw, and I recently had Terry on the show, and he gave us his version of the nude scene, but I'd like to hear yours.
His version of it? But his bare ass was in both versions.
Must have been horrific.
He was pretty horrified. I tell you that. He was caught up, yeah, I'll do that. Yeah, that's funny. Yeah, that's funny. But then he showed up the next morning, and it was time for the scene, and he was already, like, just guilt-ridden. That his mother was just going to be so angry, and how was he going to get out of this? Oh my God! And I thought he was kidding. He was seriously like, I can't believe it. And then he did it, and we all laughed, and he laughed, and he was immediately into, I'm in so much trouble. My mother, oh my God, she's going to disown me. I can't believe I did that. I can't. But he did it, and he got bare ass through a fish tank. Terry Bradshaw, he's pure.
Yeah, he's beautiful. Well, I don't know if you heard this, but I was actually Steven Soderbergh's first choice for Magic Mike. Although I think
you were.
I think you did a pretty good job in that role. How did you prepare for
Mauro
that one?
Dallas?
Yeah.
Great. Look, that's one of three roles to where when I first heard, when I talked about launch pad lines like earlier, like Wooderson, that line, I get older, they stay the same age. You're like, oh, well, who's that guy?
Yeah.
This was the second role that when Steven Soderbergh said, he's a guy named Dallas, he runs a male strip club, and he really, you know, really likes making money. And I was, like, already on my knees laughing. He was like, if you play this straight, it could be really funny. And I was like, oh, yeah, the world's already so carny. Who is this guy? And then I approached him as a capitalist rapper, you know, the Barnum of Barnum and Bailey, the ringleader.
Well, let's talk about gold.
Yeah.
You know, where, again, you play a real-life character. Who did you pattern that after?
I tell you what I patterned that after. And this is the third character. Wooderson, Dallas, the Magic Mike, and this guy, Kenny Wells, in Gold, that I read at one time and was like, oh, I've got to be this guy. I know who this is from the inside out. I can sing this song. It was, one, there was the real-life guy, David Walsh, which I found out a lot of information on that led me to go, oh, I know who this is in my own real life. This was an impression I had of a moment with my father and a guy. Day before Christmas, December 24th, 1 p.m. Gray, sleety, southwest Houston afternoon, kind of cold. He says, hey, buddy, come on with me. We're going to get some stocking stuffers. We're going to go to Walmart and get some Q-tips and, you know, fingernail clippers and things and stuff in the stocking. We get in the car and we're driving in his old Dodge Ram. And he gets off the exit about five exits before the Walmart, goes on back under the overpass and pulls into this abandoned one-story shopping mall. Broken glass, graffiti. Goes around back, white van flashes its lights. Well, what are we doing here? He pulls up next to the van, says, stay here, buddy. This is Chicago John. I'm like, oh, geez, here we go. What's this? What's going on? I'm excited, right? 17, 18 at the time. He gets out. Chicago John gets out of his van, goes to the back of the van, opens it up, and I see, like, a washing machine, hair dryers, kitchen sinks, candle holders, and he's going through all this stuff, finds his box, opens it up, pulls out this thing wrapped up in a bunch of paper towels. And when I see him open, I see my dad's shoulders go, oh, God. Gets all excited. And my dad reaches in his pocket, pulls out this envelope, and starts, I see the, from the back, this elbow going, which I know that's counting off Benjamin Franklin's, is what that is.
Yeah.
Cash. My dad gets this thing, comes back to the car. I'm sitting in the passenger seat, like, what the hell is it? He hands it to me, goes, put it in the glove box, buddies, so no one will take it. And I put this thing in the glove box and shut it, and we drive off, don't say a word. We get back on the highway. No one said a word for like 5 minutes. And I'm like, what the hell's in the glove box? And he says, open up the glove box, see if it's still there.
I'm like, is this a ferret? Is it a cobra? What the hell is it?
I open it up. In the middle console, I unwrap these paper towels, and there's this big silver watch. And my dad goes, oh, God damn it, buddy. That's a $22,000 titanium Rolex, and I just got it for $3,000. Put it up, put it up, put it up. That watch wasn't worth $500, man.
Really?
But that moment, that my dad loved a shifty deal. That impression of me, 17 years old, looking through my dad's driver's side window, at his shoulders going like that, and then his elbow counting off Benji's with a guy named Chicago John.
Nothing suspicious about that.
That, I'm like, in that transaction was Kenny Wells.
Yeah.
That moment. So it was an impression that really kind of led to me going, oh, I know who this guy is.
You know, today's your birthday, and it's only natural to look back at where you've been, but where are you headed?
Man, that's a doozy there, isn't it? Or is it a doozy? So much of what I'm doing, I'm like, I don't want to make a straight line crooked. I'm like, dude, you got some good things going on. You know, I try to measure, where am I? Am I in the credit or debit as a husband? Am I in the credit or debit as a father? Career, spiritually, AKA health. And how am I doing as a friend? And if I can keep those five in the black at different levels, maybe just barely in the black, and still keep growing, because it's gonna, things change. I know I'm a different man than I was a week ago, when I'm essentially the same guy, but I wanna keep growing, and I wanna keep challenging myself. I'm not looking to get comfortable, but I do wanna at least feel satisfied when I've done something I should feel satisfied with. I still need to work on how much significance I get out of accomplishment, you know? I'm a bit shallow in that area. I really need accomplishment to feel significant. At the same time, that's, I know, part of me that pushes me, you know? And like I said, I'm going to keep chasing myself.
Well, I think you could safely say I'm in debit this morning. It's been a fascinating morning. Thank you for joining me.
You had a wonderful time. I'm glad I crossed you on the roof in Rio, sir.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Matthew.
My pleasure.
I want to tell you a little side story that I think illuminates Matthew's character. We shot this episode on his birthday, and he was very gracious with his time, but as soon as we wrapped, he was rightly in a hurry to go celebrate the occasion. And how does this superstar celebrate? Surrounded by paparazzi at some of the latest Hollywood hotspots? Hardly. He hopped in a truck and took his kids to Sonic for some burgers, and then they hit the road to go camping. You can take the star out of small-town Texas, but you can't take small-town Texas out of this star. Well, thanks for watching, and if you'd like to see more of me, and seriously, I mean, who in their right mind would not, make sure you follow me at FaherTwit, on Faherty.com, and wherever fine china is sold. Good night, sweetie.